associates. It's somewhat mandatory for associates, and everybody's invited. And I think it was moved because of Elnora last a quarter ago, and I didn't get the memo. I should pay more attention. It's true. There is so much to divide our attention. Let's listen to a underwriting announcement from the Park District. I don't think Champaign has a hill to slide down, but they've got other nifty things to offer. And there's usually a mention of how you can find out more information about that.
Support for WEFT programming is made possible, in part, by the Champaign Park District. Box Lunch is back. On select Fridays, talented local artists will fill the historic Springer Cultural Center with a wide variety of music. Presented by WEFT. For more information, champaignparks.org.
This hour of programming is brought...
We'll hear that one a bit later. Thanks, Lori. Let's see. I generally looked for Mumia Abu-Jamal commentary, and there's not a fresh one. There's really a great one, though, recounting when he got beat up in his early days of being a Black Panther in Philly for protesting at a George Wallace rally at some kind of amphitheater. Quite a few other people inside in the penitentiary are putting up commentaries. Read a couple of titles and get on with Amy Goodman's commentary. Oh, yeah, a rundown. I've got some Amy from some time ago with this guy, Enrich. I was looking for something fresh for him. I see whether he's doing any of the economic following the money on the Epstein. Yeah, it's all Epstein today. Then a more recent feature, I'm going to excerpt a little section of what Amy had on this week about on the regular broadcast, not a web exclusive. I was thinking about doing something for Thanksgiving, and Flashpoints has a great interview with one of the American Indian Movement's colleague of Leonard Peltier. Amy Goodman's programming for Thanksgiving was an hour-long interview with Leonard Peltier, so if you missed that, you might want to go back. Quite insightful. I'm drawing a blank on which other Native American. Russell Means? No. The one who had the brother who was here visiting. Oh, well, you can go to flashpoints.net and look for that, or the KPFA archives, I guess. Already 3 minutes in, and the second half hour will be fresh stuff from a YouTube program I've never heard called Breaking Points. A couple of different hosts on the different segments. Ryan Grimm and Jeremy Scahill, the two founders of DropSite, are talking about some of the things they've dropped into the mix as an effect to the major media. They don't want to do corporate implications of Epstein's enterprise, to use a neutral word. Not the scurrilous, the awful stuff that he was doing, but the money laundering and other hot money projects and blackmailing and that kind of stuff. That's not being talked about. So anyway, we should get it started since already 5 minutes in. And here's Amy's commentary. Following on with the great Counterspin interview, this is about her week in Brazil at the COP. A lot of people are saying, you know, much ado about nothing. Well, the fate of the world is involved, and I think that's no small thing. We should know what's being done and what's not being done.
COP30's three F words, failure on fossil fuels. I'm Amy Goodman, host of Democracy Now! With Dennis Moynihan and our weekly Breaking the Sound Barrier podcast. The United Nations COP30 Climate Summit in Belém, Brazil, known as the Amazon COP, wrapped on November 22nd. Powerful petrostates and large polluting nations succeeded in blocking inclusion of a roadmap away from fossil fuels in the summit's concluding agreement. COP30 is the 30th conference of parties to the United Nations Framework Convention on Climate Change. Over 190 nations have spent a decade negotiating the implementation of the 2015 Paris Climate Agreement with little success. The alternative to COP30's drastic compromise, abandoning the roadmap that many climate-impacted nations described as a red line, was the potentially permanent collapse of the Paris Agreement. Global climate negotiations have been fraught for years as the process requires nations with vastly different resources and objectives to reach consensus. As the climate crisis worsens and the planetary ecosystem on which we all depend for survival nears multiple tipping points, it appears fossil fuel interests from the U.S., Russia, and Saudi Arabia to multinational oil corporations are scuttling climate solutions in the interest of their own power and profit. As a result, billions of people globally are being sentenced to climate devastation.
I'm angry at a really weak outcome.
Brandon Wu, ActionAid USA's director of policy and campaigns, said on the Democracy Now! NewsHour after COP30.
I'm angry at the fossil fuel lobbyists roaming the venue freely, while the indigenous activists that both of you have mentioned were actually met with militarized repression. I'm angry at all the governments that aren't standing up for their people.
Wu is among thousands from civil society at COP, demanding an ambitious and just transition from fossil fuels. These activists are allied with nations on the front lines of the climate crisis, like the small island states that dot the Pacific and Indian Oceans, where rising sea levels threaten their very existence. Vanuatu is a Pacific archipelago of about 80 islands, home to over 325,000 people. Ralph Reagan Vanu, Vanuatu's minister for climate change, spoke to Democracy Now! During COP30's final morning of scheduled negotiations.
Earlier this morning, we were informed by the presidency that there are about 80 countries who have put a red line on any mention of fossil fuels in the outcome from this meeting, this UNFCCC process, this COP.
Two camps emerged. About 80 nations, including the world's major oil producers, rejected a roadmap from fossil fuels. Another group, also with about 80 countries, including Vanuatu, demanded its inclusion. With two conflicting red lines, consensus seemed impossible. Over 1,800 scientists who make up the IPCC, the Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change, the world's leading body on climate science, conclude that global average temperature rise must be capped at 1.5 degrees Celsius, that's 2.8 degrees Fahrenheit, over pre-industrial levels to avoid the worst impacts of climate change. Reagan Vanu added,
"We need to respect the scientific consensus of the IPCC. We need to stick to the 1.5 degree goal. But we have a certain number of countries who are vested in the fossil fuel pipeline. I would say not their populations, but certain members of the political classes. And so we're seeing these people blocking progress for the entire humanity. And it's a result of this process that is flawed."
The nations demanding a roadmap to transition away from fossil fuels relented, accepting modest gains. For example, language was included supporting a future discussion on a just transition mechanism, essentially ensuring human rights will play a role in addressing the climate crisis. But ultimately, human impacts on the climate need to stop, and to do that, we need to transition off of fossil fuels. Colombia, itself an oil and coal-producing country, has offered an alternative. Colombia and the Netherlands announced on the final day of COP30 that they would co-host the first international conference on the just transition away from fossil fuels next April in Santa Marta, Colombia.
The root cause of this problem is fossil fuels.
Colombian Environment Minister Irene Vélez Torres said at the COP,
"We cannot look at the people and the future generations if we don't do something now. And we cannot accept a text that is not dealing with the real problems."
Kumi Naidu, a South African activist who fought apartheid as a teenager, then went on to head Amnesty International and Greenpeace International, observed on Democracy Now! Mid-COP,
"There's absolute corporate capture here again. There was 1,600 fossil fuel lobbyists, and even though it's a struggle to get the F word said here, but the F word, we mean fossil fuels. We need a fossil fuel phase-out plan coming out of this. The appetite is not there. We're still pushing. But whether we get it here or not, we certainly will push in April to do so in Colombia.
After COP30, as the UN climate process limps forward, all eyes are on the Colombia summit to build the global movement to finally end our addiction to fossil fuels. I'm Amy Goodman with Dennis Moynihan.
Okay. Now, as I mentioned, it's kind of an illustration of what's not being reported. This is an interview Amy did a while back with a writer who, including in his credits, has the book Dark Towers, Deutsche Bank, Donald Trump, and the Epic Trail of Destruction. In this section, he's talking about Chase and Epstein. Epstein eventually got dissociated with Chase, and of course, he went to Deutsche Bank. There's one story that's an interesting anecdote, and it's from this guy Wolf that's written the book. He was an insider with Trump. It's now written the tell-all, kind of scurrilous. It gets reported on TMZ and stuff, but he says that one of their falling out points was that they were both going after this property, and both Trump and Epstein were going after the same property, and Trump got it and then flipped it to a Russian oligarch for three times as much as he paid for it. So it looked like a money laundering scheme, and Trump beat out Epstein in that case. In his first term, I called Trump the money launderer in chief, and I think that's really the root of a lot of what his concerns about the Russia investigation was. It wasn't so much collusion, in my opinion. It was how much of the financial shenanigans that went on with Felix Satter and Trump Soho, and was he state's evidence? Did he get immunity? I don't know. It's so sordid. But here's somebody to sort it out a little bit from an earlier broadcast. And we'll get to some fresh stuff with, as I mentioned, Jeremy Scahill and Ryan Grimm, the founders that left. One concern that Scahill started that's still going on, and The Intercept, and they got an amicable settlement. They actually got seed money to start DropSite. From when they left Intercept. I don't know how all that works. Beyond my ken. Here's Amy to introduce. Well, actually, we start in the middle, don't we? I'll be excerpting the other section that was on more recently this week, where he... Oh, well, I'll let him say it.
This is Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, the War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We begin today's show looking at the growing scandal around the late convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. Both his ties to President Trump and a network of prominent politicians, academics, philanthropists, diplomats, and other...
I should have waited till that sentence ended. I'm sorry, I'm not firing on all cylinders. I don't know how many I have. This is the piece that I introduced.
Well, for many years, J.P. Morgan was basically the primary bank serving Epstein. And in the course of the 15 years that it worked with him, it did a number of things. And first and foremost, it set up accounts for not only him and his companies, but also quite a few of his victims who had been trafficked into the United States. And it arranged for Epstein to be able to pay those victims, both in the U.S. and in Eastern European countries and in Russia. The bank lent him money that was associated for projects associated with sex trafficking. It, in some cases, just paid him cash, millions of dollars of it over the years, to thank him for some of the services he had provided the bank. And over again, when people within the bank raised red flags about how much cash Epstein was withdrawing and some of the suspicious wire transfers he was doing, people higher up at the bank essentially looked the other way because they wanted to keep this guy as a lucrative client. And so, and basically, Epstein's sex trafficking operation, we now know, operated in large part because he had unfettered access to the global financial system. And for many years, it was J.P. Morgan that was providing him with that access.
Take us through the timeline. And David Enrich, what about other banks? Did Jeffrey Epstein try to bank with other banks? I mean, this is perhaps the most prestigious, the largest bank in the United States. But wasn't he turned away by bank after bank?
Well, there's some question about who turned him away and when. And certainly we know that in 2013, after J.P. Morgan, after years of internal pressure, finally parted ways with him, he went right on to another bank, the German lender Deutsche Bank, which is, you may recall, is the bank that was willing to do business with Donald Trump, among others. But the history of J.P. Morgan and Jeffrey Epstein starts in the late 1990s. And Epstein at the time was a very wealthy but kind of mysterious guy. The bank itself, in documents that we've reviewed, didn't have a whole lot of information on where his money was coming from, who he was working for, or why he was important. All they knew is that he was parking a ton of money at the bank and generating millions of dollars a year in fees. And over the ensuing years, Epstein's role inside the bank became more and more important. And it involved not just doing business that made money for the bank, but he introduced the bank to a lot of potential clients, to government leaders like Benjamin Netanyahu, and advised them on strategic initiatives and provided them kind of with troubleshooting advice along the way. So he was a really indispensable part of the bank and an indispensable partner, I think, to some of the bank's very highest ranking executives.
Now, if you could talk about the significance of this. In fact, it was two Israeli prime ministers, Benjamin Netanyahu, that he brought to the bank, as well as Ehud Barak.
Yeah. So there's a laundry list of rich, powerful, famous people that Epstein counted among his acquaintances. And he was extremely adept at using those connections to ingratiate himself with lots of other people and institutions. J.P. Morgan was very eager to do business with him and to accept the introductions he was offering. And the relationship that Epstein had with J.P. Morgan was really important to Epstein because it hooked him into the global financial system and provided him with money. But I think to an equal degree, it also imbued him with legitimacy and credibility that was really important to him, especially after he was, first in 2006, indicted and arrested on sex trafficking-related charges, and then in 2008 pleaded guilty and was then incarcerated on similar charges. And all the while, J.P. Morgan continued to bank him, and for years afterwards as well. And that was even though people within the bank, including at a pretty senior level, were aware that what Epstein had been accused of, what he had pled guilty to, and were concerned that there was a lot more going on here that hadn't even become public. And yet they decided institutionally that the right thing to do was to continue working with him, primarily because he was making them a ton of money.
He also brought to the bank Sergey Brin, right, the founder of Google, who banked with them to the tune of something like $4 billion.
Yeah, and there, again, there's a long list of people that he made introductions to. And I think the bank would say that, you know, they are one of the biggest, most prestigious banks in the world, and they don't have any trouble finding clients and on their own or talking to government leaders on their own. But there is no dispute that Epstein, at least with one of the very highest ranking executives of the bank, was someone who the bank was turning to over and over again for advice, for counseling, for introductions, and most of all, for financial services. And so this is a long symbiotic relationship. And I think that the fact that this full story hasn't been told until now is really emblematic in some ways of how many mysteries continue to swirl around Jeffrey Epstein and his money and how much more digging there is to do by everyone from journalists to congressional investigators who are, I think, belatedly getting really serious about this.
So, David Enrich, if you can explain, I don't know if everyone knows how banks work. What does it mean when there are red flags? What were those red flags? What was J.P. Morgan ignoring? When do they have to report to the feds about these red flags? And then we'll talk about Jess Staley and Jamie Dimon.
Sure. So, there was a range of red flags. The most obvious of them internally at the bank was that Epstein, he had hundreds of millions of dollars parked at the bank, but he was taking out so much money in cash on a regular basis that it was a real warning sign. And banks are kind of trained to be on the lookout for people that are regularly withdrawing huge sums of cash. And by huge sums, I mean, you know, tens of thousands of dollars virtually every month. And this drew attention within the bank. And yet when it got escalated to higher ups, people looked the other way. And the reason it draws attention is that cash is a common currency for criminals. And sure enough, what we now know is that almost identical amounts of Epstein was taking out amounts of money that were almost identical to what we now know he was paying to young women and girls as part of the sex trafficking operation. Another big red flag was that he was wiring money there were patterns of him wiring money to all over the world, including to banks and individuals in Eastern Europe and Russia that we now know. In fact, we knew to some degree at the time as well that this was a part of what appeared to be a sex trafficking operation. And these are things that anti-money laundering experts and compliance officials within J.P. Morgan and within the banking industry in general, these are pretty clear, well-established red flags for possible criminal behavior. And sure enough, the bank's teams of anti-money laundering experts and compliance officials recognized this more or less in real time and in some cases reported it to the government, but did not take it seriously internally. And, you know, they had discussions about these are suspicious things that are happening. We don't know exactly what he's using this money for, but these are red flags. And in many cases with other bank customers, we can see that when a bank customer gets accused of wrongdoing or is engaged in potentially suspicious transactions, the banks like JP Morgan will very quickly get rid of them as clients because it is not worth taking the legal or reputational risk to keep doing business with them. And again, that did not happen in JP Morgan's case. And this is not just like one isolated incident. This was happening over and over again over a period of many years where people inside the bank repeatedly rang the alarm bells and then were just overridden by people higher up the food chain.
Compare what happened to Jeffrey Epstein to Wesley Snipes.
Yeah, so, and Wesley Snipes, the actor, was another JP Morgan client in 2006. And he was accused of tax fraud by the federal government. And almost instantaneously, the and he had not been convicted of those charges. He had not admitted to those charges. Almost instantly, the bank kicked him out as a client. And this was almost exactly the same time that Epstein was initially indicted and arrested on for alleged sex crimes. And, you know, which is arguably more serious than a tax fraud allegation. And instead of swiftly kicking Epstein out of the bank the way they had done with Wesley Snipes, they had a fairly robust internal discussion that culminated in the bank deciding to keep him as a client with basically no strings attached.
We're talking to David Enrich, deputy investigations editor for The New York Times. The major new expose he co-authored headlined How J.P. Morgan Enabled the Crimes of Jeffrey Epstein. A Times investigation found America's leading bank spent years supporting and profiting from the notorious sex offender, ignoring red flags, suspicious activity and concerned executives, which takes us to the higher ups.
And again, that was from some time ago. Enrich can't find anything more recent from him. James Henry, I played something from him about the economic. He's a global justice fellow at Yale, co-founder of the DC Report with David K. Johnson, and he's not publishing anything in that about the economics. Of the situation. I played something from Background Briefing with Ian Masters, and I think I need to apologize to Chase. I said Chase instead of J.P. Morgan. I could find probably something else to complain about Chase about, but it was J.P. Morgan that was the enabler for 15 years. These money transfers, I was looking for the statistic that I know is embedded in James Henry's interview, something like 1,700 over a certain amount that had to be reported. But yeah, I can't find that. But yeah, on a great scale. Let's hear a bit of this more recent Epstein interview. This is, again, somebody who was published in the Times, so I'm suspicious because they aren't doing this other work that we'll be getting to in the second half hour.
Democracy Now!, democracynow.org, The War and Peace Report. I'm Amy Goodman. We begin today's show looking at the growing scandal around the late convicted sex offender Jeffrey Epstein. Both his ties to President Trump and a network of prominent politicians, academics, philanthropists, diplomats, and other public figures. Last week, Congress overwhelmingly voted almost unanimously, save one congressman, both in the Senate and the House, to compel the Justice Department to release all files related to Epstein, who died in 2019 in prison after he was arrested on federal charges for the sex trafficking of minors. President Trump signed legislation, but has repeatedly described the call to release the Epstein files to be a hoax. Earlier this month, he snapped at a female reporter aboard Air Force One about the Epstein files. Yep, you heard it right. Quiet, piggy, he said to the female reporter. Trump made the comment shortly after House Republicans released 20,000 files from Epstein's estate, putting a new spotlight on the late convicted sex offender's connections with a network of wealthy and powerful figures. For years, survivors of Epstein's abuse have talked about how the scandal's about far more than just Epstein. This is the late Virginia Roberts Giuffre speaking to 60 Minutes in 2019.
I was trafficked to a lot of types of different men. I was trafficked to other billionaires. I was trafficked to politicians, professors, even royalty. So the circles that Jeffrey Epstein ran in weren't your typical setting of human trafficking, you know, and It was the elite of the world. It was the people who run the world. It was the most powerful people in the world. And those are our leaders. Those are the people that we are supposed to look up to. It's corrupt. It's corrupt to the core.
That was Virginia Roberts Giuffre in 2019. She died earlier this year by suicide in Australia. We're joined now by Anand Giridharadas, author of several books, including Winners Take All, The Elite Charade of Changing the World, also the publisher of the Substack newsletter, The Ink. His recent piece for The New York Times is titled, How the Elite Behave When No One is Watching Inside the Epstein Files. Anand writes, quote, when Jeffrey Epstein, a financier turned convicted sex offender, needed friends to rehabilitate him, he knew where to turn. A power elite practiced at disregarding pain. Anand, thanks so much for being with us.
It's great to be back with you.
So talk about looking at the emails, what you looked at, and as you congratulate the women and talk about their bravery for coming forward, you take a very interesting look at who these people are that Epstein surrounded himself with, this elite network, as you talk about the Epstein class.
Look, there is no doubt that at the beating dark heart of this story is one monstrous man. In Jeffrey Epstein, who did monstrous things, as Virginia was very bravely talking about there. But I think there's a lot of powerful people in this country who would like the story to begin and end with one monstrous man. And when these emails were released, I decided, maybe against my better judgment, that I was going to read all of them. And it took me 4 or 5 days just going through one after another making notes. And I was really curious about all these other people, right? And some of them are celebrities and bold-faced names, like she was talking about. Some of them are utterly ordinary people no one's ever heard of. Some of them are professors, others. But I was interested in this larger network because these were the people that Jeffrey Epstein had, in effect, chosen to rehabilitate him socially and redeem him after he was a convicted sex offender trying to reestablish himself in society. And I was trying to understand how these relationships worked. And what I found was that it's very convenient for the American power elite to think about this as a story of one depraved man. But in fact, what the emails show, if you actually read them, is that he had chosen this particular kind of social network, this American power elite, because he could be sure that it would be able to look away at what he did, because it was very gifted at looking away over a generation at so much else, so much else, so much other abuse and suffering, whether the economic crises members of that network often helped cause, the wars members of that network helped push fraudulently, the pain of technological obsolescence that members of that network pushed on the American public. So this was a group of people well chosen by Jeffrey Epstein, because this American power elite, these circles that he moved in, if they have any superpower, it is the ability to hear the cries of people without power and close their ears.
You write powerfully in this piece. It's a tale of powerful social network in which some, depending on what they knew, were perhaps able to look away because they had learned to look away from so much abuse and suffering. And you often talk about them being on both sides of the political spectrum. You talk, and of course, it's not just American. You're talking about a British prince, though he's been stripped of that title, Andrew. You're talking about the Israeli former prime minister, Ehud Barak, and others. How did he manage to do this?
So, you know, a network, as you rightly kind of imply with the question, it needs connectivity. It needs something to hold people together. So that's what I was after as I read the emails. What was holding this together, right? Why would these people be in cahoots with such a depraved person? There's a lot of choices of people out there in the world. Well, as I read the emails, it seemed to me there were a few different things going on. One, this is a group of people who are not really loyal to the communities they come from. Their loyalty is not downward to places and communities and even countries. This is a kind of borderless network of people who are more loyal to each other than to places. And that kind of network actually needs someone who is a connector. So a lot of the emails are, hey, I'm landing in New York. Hey, I'm going to San Francisco. And then an Epstein would say, hey, you should meet this guy in San Francisco. Oh, you need an investor for your startup? Let me connect you with that. It's all about this kind of connectivity. And he was a very good connector. Second, this is a network that thrives on information barter and specifically non-public information. Again, why would they consort with this guy? Well, this guy ended up being, and not just his own information, he ended up being a kind of convener of these trades of non-public information. Investors want information that'll help them, you know, make trades that other people don't know about. You know, professors want insight about things. People in the business world want tips about things that will be the next big thing. So there was this kind of information network. Larry Summers, former Treasury Secretary, wanted dating advice.
He was Harvard president, and the dating advice, he wanted extramarital advice on how to get his mentee into bed.
Yes, while his wife was emailing with Epstein about how to contact Woody Allen.
And she was also recommending Lolita and some other book to Epstein. I don't remember her name. The name of the speaker who has the book Winner Take All, The Elite Charade of Changing the World is hard to pronounce, but I guess his Anand Giridharadas. And I guess he got to write an op-ed for the New York Times because he read in the entirety of the Epstein emails, the ones that DropSite got a hold of and are doing a lot of work on. And that's who we're going to next, which is Ryan Grimm and Jeremy Scahill. And let's see which one we'll do first. How about the one with Ryan Grimm? And their thing they're doing is talking about, going to excerpt this too. Emails show Epstein Dershowitz conspired to crush John Mersheimer and also the guy at Harvard that co-wrote the book on the Israeli lobby, AIPAC. I guess it wasn't a book. It was a very long essay that is discussed here. With again, Ryan Grimm and Jeremy Scahill started Drop Zone, and they're doing this whole series on Epstein and the other implications. They're still not doing money laundering as much as I'd like, but they're doing the intelligence connection and financial connections. And so this is a story. John Mersheimer is at the University of Chicago, has the dissident view about Ukraine. I used him in an article that I wrote. Stephen Cohen lamentably died too young, and he would have been, he's also a good source on that dissident view. And I feel like I need to do something about that on the air. It's a complicated story. I did write a piece in the Public Eye some time ago that lays out my thoughts on the case, barbaric situation that we're in, but U.S. complicity in sabotaging peace processes for its own purposes are never visited. Let's visit something with John, with Ryan Grimm, and the host does introduce herself, perhaps. This is from the show I just found because I was looking for stuff with Ryan Grimm and Jeremy Scahill. It's called Breaking Points. Sorry, why is it? It seems to be counting down.
Okay, I found this on the web for why is it seems to be counting up. Down. Check it out.
Okay, I've just solved my simple problem. It's muted.
National Relations professors at the University of Chicago. Published a paper called The Israel Lobby. It also ran in the London Review of Books. And you would think, okay, that's the most boring thing I can think of. Like two yes. academics published a paper that also ran in the London Review of Books. Okay, that's interesting. But why is the entire world supposed to care about that? The world lit up on fire. It is shot through with all of these caveats and apologetics that they're even broaching this subject. But they make a basic argument that a loose coalition of supporters of Israel in the United States have built a network and a lobbying infrastructure that has given Israel outsized influence on American foreign policy and at times has driven American foreign policy away from its own national interests and toward the interests of Israel. That was viewed as an absolutely shocking thing to say in polite society. And what genuinely concerned the lobby was particularly that Walt was saying it, because Walt, as and Mearsheimer was at the time very highly respected. He is today a highly respected academic among people like us, mm-hmm. but he took a huge hit in his mm-hmm. reputation inside academia over as a result of the pushback against this. Walt was, as the dean of the academic school of Harvard's Kennedy School, that's like the plum position in that field. Like that's the dean of all of it, not just Harvard, but basically all of it. So to have somebody like him saying this, the fear was that this was going to open up, that this was going to create a permission structure for people just to debate and talk openly about the influence of the pro-Israel lobby in the United States. And so that had to be shut down. And the pushback against it was like nothing anything academia had really ever seen. Talks were canceled. It's like some pre-cancel culture type of stuff going on. What we're reporting over at Drops, two other details. One, who was president of Harvard at the time? Epstein buddy, Larry Summers.
You guessed it.
Who was either the main funder or one of the top funders of the Kennedy School? Les Wexner, the Wexner Foundation. And who controlled the Wexner Foundation's money? Jeffrey Epstein. So all those facts are known. Now what we know from
Epstein himself was donating heavily to Harvard at the time as well.
And Epstein himself was too. Okay. But he was more influential for his control of Wexner's fortune. Mm-hmm. But he himself was giving millions. But now what we can report from his inbox, which as I mentioned last week, we currently have exclusive access to, thanks to distributed denial of secrets, which is making they're making it available to other journalists as well, is that Epstein himself was involved with Dershowitz. Mm-hmm. In kind of circulating Dershowitz, giving feedback to Dershowitz's counterargument, which the school published, and helping to circulate it. And so he was involved. He was directly involved in the coordinated campaign to undermine this paper, which means that a paper making a claim that a loose kind of collection of pro-Israel supporters are leveraging their money and their resources and their connections was undermined by a loose coalition of Israel supporters operating behind the scenes, using their connections and their financial resources. As you said, so it's disconnected from this pushback. But that same week in the inbox, mm-hmm. we found Dershowitz and Epstein going back and forth over Epstein's latest sex abuse allegation. And this one was from somebody who said she was 14 when she was abused. And you have Epstein with this kind of list of reasons why this girl's credibility should be called into question. Things that she had said on the internet.
Because he had hired a private detective, you're reporting,
right,
to follow this girl around.
Or to at least to research her. Yeah, I don't know if he was following or if it was just like online research. This was like 1 week
virtually
of research.
Following. Okay.
Right. It may have gone beyond that. We don't know. Mm-hmm. But what we know is that they unearthed a bunch of dirt on this girl. And he's saying, and so they're going back and forth. Dershowitz is telling Dershowitz, who was his lawyer in this case, to give this to the state attorney to tell him that he should not be going forward with these charges because this girl is not to be believed. So that was the twin campaigns that they were running at the time.
Just these inboxes, because there are multiple, are such wild glimpses into what was happening behind the scenes and how elites are operating, not just Epstein and Dershowitz and Summers, but more broadly. And that last bit, Ryan, is particularly irritating because you'll remember when it was Rising. There was an episode of Rising where Alan Dershowitz was booked, and it was you, Robbie, and me. And at one point, Dershowitz flew off the handle and said that we wouldn't have wanted John Adams to defend the Boston massacre, the British in the Boston massacre case, which is, I think, when you're looking at these emails that you have about a private investigator being hired by Jeffrey Epstein to dig up dirt on a 14-year-old girl, the obvious difference, you don't even need to know that was happening behind the scenes to make the case that the obvious difference is John Adams believed with every fiber of his being that he was doing the right thing, that he was defending. He wasn't just a defense attorney. He was defending the right cause, that his side was correct in this case. Did Dershowitz think that Jeffrey Epstein was just clean as a whistle, had never done anything wrong, morally pure? Of course not. Of course not.
Right.
That's laughable.
And their relationship over working together on the Israel lobby actually is directly relevant to this claim. Because let's say, okay, use the John Adams argument where you say, even our worst enemies in our fair system deserve representation. So that's the argument. But what if you also found out that John Adams was secretly working behind the scenes with the British on other unrelated matters?
Yeah.
In order to undermine other people, showing that they actually are a team, that they are not, that it is not that Adams is just defending the principle that everybody deserves a good lawyer. It's not that Dershowitz is representing Epstein, even though he understands he's an awful person, but he thinks that everybody deserves an attorney. Like, that's clearly not what, that's clearly not what is happening with Dershowitz, because he's working with him secretly to undermine Mearsheimer and Walt's book.
Right.
That has nothing to do. You're not required to do that. Like, you clearly believe that he's your ally.
Yeah.
In this ideological effort. So I think we can dispense with this idea that Dershowitz was a reluctant defender of Epstein, and he did it on the principle that everybody deserves an attorney.
It's also amazing.
Because he was secretly working with him on this Israel lobby book.
It is amazing to go back and think of the early days of Dershowitz's self-defense of his relationship with Epstein, and then compare what he said then to what we're seeing behind the scenes in these emails that I'm sure he never thought would see the light of day, which is, whatever they're talking about, Mearsheimer or the case, they were not just business colleagues and they were not just casual business acquaintances. They had a close relationship. Obviously, yeah. They had a close relationship.
They were
allies. Close conspirators. They were, yeah, yeah, they were allies. They were, you know, I don't mean conspirators in a legal sense. It just mean that they were behind the scenes operating closely
conspiring.
Together. Yeah. I mean, obviously, in this case, there's a little conspiring that's taking place. But it's just, I think, worth thinking back to how he said, yeah, well, you know, I defended him as his lawyer, met with him a couple of times. I'm paraphrasing, obviously, what the defense was back then, but laughable at this point.
Yeah, and Dershowitz is the man that Barry Weiss wants to hold up as a paragon of serious, you know, center-left charisma,
yep.
The kind of person that's going to, you know, bring young people, you know, back. So, Griffin, if you have this, let's play it. And play the whole thing because it's
yes,
funny.
You got.
We're not going to hear Barry Weiss for 2.5 minutes. I guess she's offering Dershowitz as sort of some moderating center left person in her analysis. She's was a columnist at the Times and is now a mover and shaker at CBS since Ellison's Paramount deal, all that. Yeah, the specifics you can find. And again, that was Ryan Grimm in conversation with Emily Jasinski, and I did look her up. She cut her teeth in conservative media, so she's with this group now called Breaking Points, at least for part of her work. Yeah, but now we'll hear a different person interviewing, a couple people interviewing the other founder of Dropsite News, and that's Jeremy Scahill. Let's see if I got that queued up. I seem to. And make sure we're not on mute. This one is titled, BB Shares Ryan Grimm Epstein Story in Shock Admission. This is some internal Israeli politics. BB is sharing a Jacobin article because it says nasty things about his political opponent, Ehud Barak.
I've ever seen. D2, guys, let's put it up here on the screen. Is Bibi Netanyahu sharing a Jacobin article about Jeffrey Epstein claimed to have meddled in Israel's elections, which references Dropsite reporting? Jeremy, I just, you know, Dropsite co-founder, what is your reaction here? And break down some of the reporting that you guys actually put out and why Bibi seems to be entranced by it.
You know, this is a story also that has not, for the most part, penetrated the broader corporate media or the Western media at all. My colleagues, Ryan Grimm and Murtaza Hussein, have just been churning out expose after expose. And, you know, even some people in the alternative media landscape are mischaracterizing what they're actually reporting and saying that it's this salacious gossip thing and sort of comparing it, you know, to Russiagate, you know, hysteria. This is very serious reporting that is showing these deep ties that Jeffrey Epstein had to very powerful individuals in Israel. Ehud Barak, the former Israeli prime minister, has been at the center of a number of these reports showing his connections to Jeffrey Epstein, Mossad figures who were staying at Epstein-linked properties, Epstein weighing in and advising on Israeli electoral politics, which is what caused Netanyahu to come out and post a Jacobin article, which is extraordinary. And you know, in the Hebrew language press, people are sort of losing their mind about this,
yeah,
and saying, you know, Netanyahu, you know, is so desperate to sort of distract from, you know, his other narratives that he's even willing to put forward stories from quote unquote anti-Israel news outlets. But this is very serious reporting that Ryan Grimm and Murtaza Hussein are doing. And it's really malpractice that other major news organizations are not focusing on this. They're going straight for some of the, you know, other things that are newsworthy. And this is all sort of being distilled through the lens of Capitol Hill politics. But we're showing yet again that someone who was in contact with Bill Clinton, someone who was in contact with Donald Trump, someone who was in contact with very powerful people in both corporate and government entities in the United States was simultaneously in communication with the power brokers in Israel and clearly had ties to Israeli intelligence.
Yeah. It's crazy. Yeah. It's so crazy.
Yeah. I mean, what could be more important than understanding these dimensions of power that are usually invisible to the public, whether it's the American public or the global public, and to get a window into these emails back and forth and the way these deals are being done? I mean, it's hard for me to think of what topic you could explore that would be more significant, more consequential. You know, to your point about the freak out of this Bibi Netanyahu's sharing of a Jacobin article, which is a pretty wild thing. Former Prime Minister Ehud Barak, who of course is the subject and whose email inbox was the one that was hacked, which is why Ryan and Maz have been able to do so much of this reporting. He actually got asked a question about this and responded to it. Let's go ahead and play D3.
The publication was in a kind of publication named Jacobin or something like this, which is an extremely anti-Semitist and extremely anti-Israeli publication. I wonder how it comes that the prime minister found the time to identify it. Probably it was held by his son, who spent his time now not in the front, but in Miami. And the whole story is nonsense. You know, it's probably Epstein tried to aggrandize a little bit his role and his activities and so on. I regret of ever meeting him. I was quite friendly with him for years, met many times on business issues and others. This story of intervening in Israeli election is total nonsense.
Classic to frame them as anti-Semitic, of course.
Well, also, you know, when you're desperate, when you've been exposed, what you try to do then is attack the messenger, implying that facts are not facts because of the news outlet where they happen to be published. And I should say, by the way, that, you know, Jacobin does very rigorous journalism. And certainly the stories that we've been doing for DropSite have been fact checked. They've been legally reviewed. We go for comment to the relevant parties involved. Ehud Barak has refused to offer any comment on this. So the facts are going to speak for themselves, as in all responsible journalism they should. So, you know, whether Barak wants to actually take this on or he wants to minimize his relationship with Epstein, I think that his own emails tell a story that is very devastating for him and speaks to something much broader about the cozy relationship that Jeffrey Epstein had to power brokers across continents.
I think what's so fascinating to me about this entire story is how the Israelis are currently feuding amongst themselves over whether Epstein was an Israeli asset. But the US media is ignoring all of this work. And I think the reason why it's important at a more meta level is for what we began this with, is that Israel is currently violating this Lebanon ceasefire. We also have, I believe we have some of the reports here about this most recent attack in Gaza. D6, can we put that up there on the screen? I mean, they just launched strikes in Gaza in a, quote, latest test of ceasefire as some 24 Gazans were killed. So Jeremy, even this 10 U.S. ceasefire is not sticking, and the strikes, at the very least, are continuing at a much lower level.
Yeah, imagine, you know, imagine if Hamas had killed 24 Israelis. Right. Do you think it would be a test of the ceasefire? Anyway, go ahead, Jeremy.
Yeah, I mean, what we're seeing here is that, you know, Trump essentially saved Israel from itself when he pushed through this deal. You know, Israel had totally failed to cause a surrender of the Palestinian resistance. The Qassam Brigades and Soraya al-Quds and the broader armed resistance in Gaza didn't wave the white flag. They were still holding 20 Israeli captives. And, you know, Israel killed a number of its own captives over the 2 years of the genocide. Those Israeli captives were not going to be released by military force. Trump put a big emphasis on wanting to get them freed for his own reason. I think Trump genuinely didn't understand the Nobel Peace Prize process. And I think he thought he was going to sort of get in under the wire and force this deal so that he could pick up the Nobel Peace Prize, even though the voting had already happened and he wasn't up for it, you know, in this round. But also this constellation that we've talked about on this program before of these corporate and business interests involving the Trump family business, the Trump organization, money from Arab Gulf states. But what I would say in the broader sense is that this so-called peace agreement is a net positive for Israel and Netanyahu, because Netanyahu was facing indictment by the International Criminal Court. He had his own criminal proceedings that are still underway inside of Israel. Israel wasn't militarily actually winning the war against Gaza. What it was succeeding in doing was mass murdering large numbers of Palestinians, overwhelmingly women and children. And what Trump is doing here is twofold. On the one hand, they're trying to rebrand what Israel has done over the past 2 years of this genocide as somehow the precursor to this epic peace. And he went to the Knesset. He gave this kind of reverse Nuremberg tribunal performance where it was the war criminals celebrating themselves. And Israel's war of annihilation agenda is going to continue in a rebranded format. And now they're saying that the main issue is we need to disarm the Palestinians. Trump pulled off an enormous diplomatic coup by getting the United Nations Security Council to endorse his so-called Board of Peace. What this is the UN authorizing Trump to be commander-in-chief of what is almost certainly going to be a largely privatized military force that is going to deploy in Gaza with a central mission of disarming the Palestinians. This is a huge victory for Israel also, because Israel, which constantly attacks the United Nations, can say, now the UN Security Council has said the Palestinians need to bend the knee. The Palestinians don't actually have a right to armed resistance. And so what I think we're going to see now is this huge push demanding that the Palestinians disarm. I just got done speaking to a wide range of leaders from Palestinian resistance factions, both armed and unarmed. And what I think we're seeing is that, with the exception of Mahmoud Abbas, who has single-digit popularity from the Palestinian Authority, he endorsed this move at the UN Security Council. Every single other Palestinian faction is rejecting it right now. And so if this is going to call the question on it. If Trump actually wants there to be a lasting peace agreement, they need to back off of this colonialist agenda. Whether Hamas or Palestinian Islamic Jihad are sort of gone from the scene is irrelevant to this history. There's going to be other groups that are going to rise up. One bit of nuance here, though, that I want to report to you guys. When I was speaking to Mohammed al-Hindi, who is one of the co-founders of Palestinian Islamic Jihad, one of the most senior Palestinian resistance figures still alive and participated directly in the negotiations, and I asked him about this issue of disarmament, he said something interesting, which is that if you establish a Palestinian state and you have a Palestinian armed force capable of defending itself, you won't have a need for Islamic Jihad or Hamas. But he also said that they told Steve Witkoff and Jared Kushner very clearly that they are open to something that is akin to a sort of decommissioning process. That is, that if you had a UN peacekeeping force coming in, separating the Israelis from the Palestinians and stopping the genocide, standing in the middle, and you established a Palestinian force, it could even be a police force, and it could even be under the control of the Palestinian Authority, which has endorsed Trump's plan, that they would engage in a long-term truce with Israel, where any weapons that appear on the street from someone, that that individual could be arrested, that they would shut down the training sites, and that they would make a long-term commitment that the resistance would not use its weapons. If you actually want to preserve Palestinian rights, and you also want to achieve an idea that there isn't going to be armed groups running around with weapons, the Palestinians have a very moderate position on this that no one ever wants to talk about. It's this maximalist position of Israel, which isn't actually even about the guns, because we're talking about very small arms that are overwhelmingly homemade inside of Gaza. Israel is using this as a proxy to try to win the surrender of the Palestinian cause, something it hasn't been able to do militarily for 77 years. So, you know, if there's any U.S. negotiators watching this, I suggest you actually listen to the nuance of what the Palestinians are saying, because it's not a secret. And their position, quite honestly, is a very reasonable one, given the fact that there's been this genocide. But telling the people that have had a genocide committed against them, now is the time that you have to be stripped of all of your weapons, is just a sick sentiment that is being foisted upon the Palestinian people right now. And it's not a serious negotiating position.
Interesting. All right, Jeremy.
Control room, let's put Jeremy's reporting up on the screen here as the first element in the block. And, you know, Jeremy, you can tell me the headline you have here is Weapons of Willpower, Hamas and Islamic Jihad on Trump's Gaza Plan. And people really need to go and read this. First of all, you have sort of the TikTok of how this deal came to be and what the thinking was from the Palestinian resistance factions, how they're viewing the quote-unquote ceasefire at this point, the sort of gamble that they took in deciding to make this deal and what their current thinking and position is now. But in a sense, and you could tell me if I'm wrong about this, I'm sort of getting like Abraham Accord vibes where there's this, oh, we've achieved peace in the Middle East, and you're just completely pretending like the Palestinians don't exist anymore, like they're not going to have any kind of a say in what the final outcome is here. And of course, yeah, you know, we saw the way that that thinking all blew up on October 7th. You know, is that kind of the picture, is we're just going to pretend like these people don't exist and don't really have a say, and we're just going to bulldoze forward and pretend like we've achieved some sort of monumental Middle Eastern peace without working out any of these more difficult details?
Yeah, of course. I mean, my colleague Jawa Ahmed and I interviewed major Palestinian resistance figures from both Hamas and Islamic Jihad. And I would just say that it is journalistic malpractice on the part of Western news organizations not to conduct these kinds of interviews. It's also a disservice to the public, because when you actually speak to Palestinians that are often demonized and dehumanized in the media, primarily those that represent the armed resistance factions in Hamas, you get a very different sense of what their position is than when you just allow it to be filtered through the microphone of Netanyahu or, unfortunately, even Steve Witkoff. And so, you know, what we tried to do was basically say, this is a real story and we should understand what their position is. And what they're saying to us is that almost all of the discussions happening about what should happen in Palestine are taking place without actually speaking to the Palestinians who are going to be impacted by it or need to sign up for any agreement. It seems like they want to just try to make a deal, not even involving Mahmoud Abbas, but using the fact that he's head of the Palestinian Authority. When you have a wide range of Palestinian factions that have agreed on a set of principles that are a sound basis for negotiating. So if I, as an independent journalist, can seek out these people and talk to them to just fact check what is their actual position, then U.S. negotiators should be doing the same on a regular basis before announcing to the world decisions they've made on behalf of an occupied people or that's going to be imposed on an occupied people.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for joining us, Jeremy. Incredible reporting as always. We appreciate you, man.
Thank you, guys. Keep up the great work.
Thanks. Hey, if you like that video, hit the like button or leave a comment below. It really helps get the show.
Breaking points. That broke faster than I thought. That's a show that the premises of two different hosts from progressive and conservative points of view. Crystal Ball is the woman you heard there. She's the progressive host. And they both left The Hill. Maybe that was a podcast. Chris Sagar and Jetty is the other person speaking, and he's the conservative host. Earlier, I played Ryan Grimm, and he actually was on Breaking Points, but he was with someone he knows well, the conservative Emily Jashinsky, and they have a program, Ryan Grimm, of the drop site, co-host Counterpoints. So, there you have it. That's what they do. Okay. Let's see what I did with some, what I'll do with the 6 minutes here. I don't know why that timed out shorter than I thought. I think I want to replay the commentary from Mumia Abu-Jamal. From he doesn't put out so many these days. It's a pity. But this one flashes back to his early days as a Black Panther. Wish he was doing more. He's written I don't know how many books while incarcerated. This one's called Wars of Freedom of Speech. Opinions you hear here are those of the speakers, of course, not necessarily shared by others. Station Radio Free Labor coming up. Gus is raring to go. Here's Mumia.
Wars of the Freedom of Speech. The U.S. gets kudos all around the world for its heralded First Amendment rights, including the right to freedom of speech. Does the record suggest that? Let's examine it. Years ago, during the last months of the 60s, about four young brothers, including myself, went to the Spectrum, a huge arena in South Philly, to protest the appearance of Governor George Wallace of Alabama, who was there to give a speech in support of his presidential campaign. We viewed Wallace, an arch segregationist, as a racist, and we wanted our voices to be heard. We shouted Black Power in the arena and got rushed out by security guards and police. When we left, we were all beaten by plainclothes cops. All of us have scars on our bodies from injuries we sustained that night. How free was free speech if we paid for it in blood, scars, and injuries? Fast forward to today, to the fall of 2024, when students were awakened to the genocidal carnage against Gazans in Palestine for speaking and speaking out against Zionist violence against Palestinians. Many of these students were suspended or expelled from their schools. Some students had their job offers withdrawn. How free is free speech when students are expelled or their life careers are threatened? And let's look at this. Today, there were thousands and thousands of Latinos and Hispanics all across the country who are terrified of speaking their language, Spanish, in the streets of the United States for fear of being thrown into a car by men with masks and then thrown into a cell and then exported out of the country to God knows where. Does that sound like free speech to you? Free speech is a bourgeois promise that ignores more than it protects. And bourgeois promises make it real. Protect free speech with love, not fear. This is Mumia Abu-Jamal.
These commentaries are recorded by Prison Radio.
Okay, he doesn't do them weekly like he has been in the past, but good health to him. Thanks for listening. I guess I'll disclaim again, even though I think I already did here on WEFT, Champaign-Urbana. The opinions you hear are those of the speakers. There's an associates meeting coming up on December 1st. All are welcome to come. And you can go to the website and find the Zoom connection for that meeting. Here's Lori Coey, Blues host, doing an underwriting announcement for a local business I'm fond of. I found my Moxibustion kit that I got from them.
acupuncture. Urbana Acupuncture offers safe, gentle, and effective relief for pain and stress while promoting overall health. Urbana Acupuncture, located inside Lincoln Square Mall in downtown Urbana. For more information and scheduling, please visit urbana-acu.com.